great.
All right, so I'm Lorene Grenier, and Seth Hinsey's walking around over there, and this is our very beautiful assistant, Martin Murray. We're going to talk to you today about TCP with spoofed IPs and a little tool that we're working on called Homunculus, which is a... Homunculus.
Homunculus. Say that five times fast. Are you ready?
There was someone that promised to bring me tequila, but he's not in the room. What can I do?
I got vodka. I don't have tequila, sorry.
Is it in a bottle?
Yeah.
Can we have it?
Sure.
Alrighty.
Hold on a second.
Alright. Do you want me to wait for you before I start talking?
Oh, please go right back.
Alrighty. Okay, so, why on earth would we want to start a TCP session with a spoofed IP? Well, obviously, anonymity. There are two types of anonymity, long and short term. So long term anonymity is when you kind of want to hide your identity from who you're talking to. Maybe you're doing something not so nice, I don't know. But in the long run, you don't want the feds to knock on your door. So you spoof your IP. And then there's short-term anonymity. I looked a long time for another way to say this, but no one could come up with anything interesting. Basically, what this means is that we want to stop an IDS from putting together one and one to make two and decide that they need to start setting up alarms. So say you've got an IDS that needs three things to happen in sequence, and then it'll start sending pages out to people, telling them to come look at the network, or locking it down, say, if it's an account. So what we want to do is do those three things, get the benefits from them as an attacker, but not let the IDS know that those three things are happening and set off its alarm or lock things down. Yeah, it's like shots from the grassy knoll. Kinda.
Well, we don't know where they're coming from.
Yeah, but we know the president's dead.
Yeah, true.
Okay, so why is this interesting? No, that's what we're getting at. In past, people would use things like botnets, machines that they'd compromised, and they'd have, in effect, different shooters. We're just going to have one shooter in three places at once, or however many places. So why is this interesting? People have been spoofing IPs for a long time with UDP and ICMP and all this great stuff. TCP creates a virtual stream. It's a connection protocol. It's stateful. There's a three-way handshake. They get together and send things back and forth, and you have to hear both sides. You have to get sequence numbers, all this good shit. So we'll go back for a second. Up until now, people have, for the most part, done some things with TCP and spoofed IPs, but mostly it's treating it just like UDP. I'm going to fire off that initial packet, not care about what comes back, and see what you can do based on initiating something but not hearing the results directly from who you're sending to. So the first thing people do is SYN floods. You're a computer, you've got a port open. Whenever there's initial connection, you allocate some memory, set up a buffer, you do all those great things that you do when a connection starts. And obviously, you can only have so many people connected to a service at one time. So what a SYN flood's going to do is send a bunch of SYNs, obviously, initiate a bunch of connections that don't exist, and wait for the ACK to come back from its SYNACK, and it's going to wait there for the connection to time out, obviously. So if you send a bunch of them in quick succession, no one else can log in because, you know, it's drop tail. Anything else that comes is going to get cut off if the buffer's full. Or, you know, in some really bad implementations, they just run out of memory and die.
What's it called, a SYN flood or SYN? Explain SYN.
Oh, SYN. Does everyone know what SYN is? Does everyone understand the TCP handshake? Does anyone not understand it, want me to talk about it? Don't be shy. Someone raise your hand. Alrighty, everyone knows what SYN is. Okay, another thing you might want to do, reconnaissance. You might want to port scan somebody. You might want to know what ports they have open. So there's three methods for using spoofed IPs with scanning. The first is misinformation. then there's by IP sequence number observation, and then indirect observation. So spoofed IPs is misinformation. We want to scan a host. We're going to send a bunch of SYNs. We're going to see what it sends back to us to try to tell if the port is open or closed. Obviously, the port is open. We're going to get a SYNACK. If it's closed, we're going to get a reset. If it's firewalled off, we're not going to get anything. So we're going to send the SYNs off, blah, blah, blah. So misinformation. If we scan, send the SYNs from 100 different hosts and ourselves, or better yet, 100 different existing hosts, what's going to happen is whoever's getting scanned, if they realize they're getting scanned, is going to have to go through 100 different people to find you and decide that you're the one that actually scanned them. Excuse me, anybody?
When the Nmap, or what he suggested was looking at the time to live, because when Nmap first implemented this, one of the methods used to get around it was to look at the TTL values for the received packets, look at all of the IP addresses that were used, and see where the TTL matches. TTL is a value in the TCP header. It's decremented by one for each hop, obviously. If you've got an IP address that is 30 hops away, but yet the TTL only has been decremented 5 times, or it got decremented 40 times, that's not correct. However, with new versions of Nmap, they now randomize the time to live as well. But there are other methods. Yeah, they work better or worse, depends on who you're attacking and how smart they are.
Yep, so as you're talking about Nmap, the dash D Nmap is for decoys. That's what that'll do. So then there's sequence number observation. So what we do is we pick a host that exists to be our zombie, and we pick a target. We send a ping off to the zombie, and we get its IP sequence number. Now, unlike the TCP sequence number, the IP sequence number, for the most part, is not randomized, although in OpenBSD it is randomized before Mary says anything. So you can't use OpenBSD boxes as zombies. Is that my vodka? Sweet. All right. So once we've got this IP sequence number, what we're going to do is send a spoofed SYN to our target with the from spoofed as the zombie. And we're not going to see... Ooh. I didn't even drink any of it yet. We're not going to see what happens between the target and the zombie, but we don't need to. We're then going to ping the zombie again and figure out what that IP sequence number is after the traffic we've instigated. So if the port on the target is open, it's going to send a SYNACK back to the zombie, and the zombie's going to say, what the hell is this? Reset. And it'll increment the IP sequence number by one. If the port is closed, it's going to send a reset back to the zombie, and the zombie is just going to throw it out, because when you get a reset for no reason, you just ignore it. It's not going to increment it at all. When we ping it again, it's going to increment by one when it sends the echo back. So we know that if it's only incrementing by one, then port's closed. If it's incrementing by two, one for the target traffic and one for our traffic, then the port's open. And the third method is indirect observation, which is what we're going to do with Homunculus. It requires the ability to sniff packets sent to the zombie. And what you're going to do is send a packet as the zombie, see what it sends back. Zombie can be existent or non-existent. It doesn't really matter. Okay, so what if the zombie doesn't exist? Well, it doesn't send anything back. Or if it's firewalled off, we'll talk about that soon. If the zombie's in a sniffable portion of the network, it's in your subnet, your ARP spoofing to get past, you know, switches, stuff like that, then we can respond for the zombie. So we start up a TCP connection with a machine that doesn't exist or does exist firewalled. So using firewalls as zombies, why don't you talk about this, Seth, because this one was yours.
You can have a drink.
I have some vodka.
This kind of came to me in as we were thinking of cool applications for this. And most people know that firewalls obviously close off ports, and when they get random traffic, they just kind of ignore it. So we figured that because firewall ports return nothing when they're queried, there's no reset, then if you spoof the starting of a connection from a machine, and that machine is firewalled, when it gets the reply back, it's not going to send a reset, it's just going to drop it. So if you have the ability to sniff the reply from the server, you can effectively hold a conversation as a zombie, and nobody would know any the wiser. So, So who uses a personal firewall? Soon, everybody, as a lot of people know, that Microsoft took a lot of heat for having XP not have their firewall enabled. So with Service Pack 2, it will be, and Windows machines will be free reign for using them as a host to do pretty much anything you want, whether it's go on, you know, Kazaa and Still Music, hack websites, and all the fingers point back to the machine that has a firewall on it, which is kind of interesting. So you don't really have to worry about it. And as far as any network things go, if you can sniff them, then there's really no way that anybody would know except for you that this is taking place. So you want to?
I guess I'll do this. So why would we want to do any of this? We can create non-existent honeypots like Honeydew does. We'll look at that in a moment. We can simulate attacks from real botnets for testing purposes to see if your IDS can handle this sort of thing, or you know, attacks from botnets. We can maintain long-term anonymity from malicious TCP activity. We could brute force accounts without alerting IDSs, and we can hack the Gibson. Actually, yeah, you heard it here first. The reason that we're giving this talk right now is because of a talk that the eBay security guy gave at Microsoft last summer. And his claim, he talked about a lot of ways to people would break into eBay accounts. One of the ways was people would use a large number of bots, say 100 different IP addresses. In case you don't know, the odds for picking a random password and breaking into someone's account is that if you pick 100 random passwords and you try them all against a random account, you will probably get in. The odds are highly in your favor. So along with this, if you pick one random password and try 100 accounts, odds are high that you'll get in. So if somebody tries 10 passwords on your account, they block the account. If an IP tries 100 different tries for different usernames, obviously they're going to block the IP. But if you use 100 different IPs to 100 different accounts with randomized passwords, you're going to get in eventually, and they can't really stop it. The way that they're doing it now to decide if people are doing something like this is to check to see if the person is using a sorted password list. And they profile to see if the passwords that are being tried randomly are in alphabetical order or something like that. And they actually catch a lot of people that way. So if you're going to do this, make sure you randomize your list 3 times. So the limitations. We have to be able to sniff the traffic. So we have to be in the subnet. We have to be able to ARP spoof, stuff like that. Plus, they're easily detected. If you start a connection to somewhere with a machine that doesn't exist, and all that's implemented is that one part of traffic, somebody pings it, obviously they're not going to get anything back. It'll be like, it's down. They can try a bunch of other things. You know, they're not going to get anything from this machine aside from the traffic that's happening. So if they wanted to really find out what was going on, they would notice. So on to Honeydew. Honeydew was written by Niels Provos, I think entirely, right? Pretty much what Honeydew does is it implements virtual machines in the same way, much the same way. Actually, have you worked on Honeydew at all, or do you want to come up and help us talk about this? Sure. All right, come on. We got to bring Marius up here.
This is Marius Erickson, hacker extraordinaire. Just explain to us Honeydew.
Yeah, give the people a.
Well, Honeydew essentially just. Simulates a number of nodes on the network by responding to, you know, ARP requests, and it just implements a simple virtual network stack, and it also is takes the Nmap fingerprint, so it's able to simulate various different network stacks, essentially. So, you know, if you Nmap the honeypot, it'll come up with all sorts of different, you know, interesting results. And you can also simulate services. And the way that's done is that, you know, you attach, you know, a service to a port, and it actually launches a process. So, like, you know, you could simulate some sort of telnet service and launch a shell script or something. And that way you could, you know, for example, print some Cisco banner or something. But it essentially just allows you to build these arbitrary honeypot networks. And also, and additionally, the network can even be have a non-flat topology. So you can essentially create routers and it'll, you know, you can see the packets go through that network, and it'll decrement the TTL appropriately and have, you know, random or have certain packet loss characteristics and certain you know, random delay characteristics and everything. And so it's pretty much a very complete application to simulate a network of hosts, or, you know, and as I said, it doesn't even have to be a flat topology. So that's what it is.
Yep, that's pretty much everything I was going to say, and some extra stuff. In addition to impersonating services, they can be proxied to other actual existing machines. So, you know, all the services that are caught by a machine that doesn't actually exist can be sent to another machine, and it'll actually scrub the IPs and all the info to make it look like there wasn't an extra hop, and, you know, it's still coming from that IP. So how is it different from what we're doing? It's more complicated and flexible. Actually, you can ping machines, and it'll be like they're actually there. You know, we don't have that the limitation that we were talking about earlier, but the usage is different, and it lacks some important features necessary for attack. Basically, you have to own the head router, because you have to route those IPs to the HoneyD machine. It's not going to go out and get them. And obviously, if you're hopping on wireless and creating a billion bots to break into eBay or testing anything, then pen testing, you're going to want to be able to go out and make them route to you automatically. So how can we protect our networks from things like this, bots, real and imaginary? You can protect your network with HoneyD. You can make HoneyD route all of the non-existent IPs. You just set it up with DHCPD. Anything that's not leased should be picked up by HoneyD and have a reset sent back. That way nobody can hop on your network, create a million non-existent machines, and kind of take off. Use up free IPs. Or you can know which IPs are valid on your network. That's a little bit of a pain in the butt. So what if you're the target? Well, obviously, you can't profile attacks by IP strictly. You have to do something extra, like eBay was doing with sorted password lists. You can also use IP sequence numbers if those aren't, you know, explicitly scrubbed by whoever is doing this sort of attack. They're going to be incremented by one, no problem. I know I had something else interesting to say about this profiling attacks by. Oh yes, in certain circumstances, say the person who's setting up the botnet is on a /24. If they all have the same route, or the same first 24 bits, then you can probably assume that they're on 255.255.255.0, and you can profile all of those IPs as one single machine. If they're differing any of the other ways up, then you really have no idea how big the subnet is, and you can't really profile like that. But that's one way to try and catch it. So basic stuff that we looked at, HoneyD, you can look at that later. And thanks for this talk. Neil's looked over all our HoneyD stuff and made sure it was right, and City rocks hardcore. And Martin keeps me warm. So does anybody have any questions about any of this stuff? Anybody? No questions. Do we have the source code? We have some of the source code, but it's not going to be released. Yeah. Yeah, libnet is totally the shit. And so is libevent. Plug.
So it seems to me that if you run HoneyD with RFP
Yep, that's true. HoneyD can very easily be adapted to do the exact same thing without much work, but it's not the way it's currently implemented.
Part of the difference is more that HomunculusD is designed for making outgoing requests, whereas HoneyD is designed for responding to requests. And so while they both have to implement a certain amount of response, it would take a fairly significant modicum of changes to HoneyD to allow it to go out and make attacks. It's designed to respond. Actually, it's designed to...
It will do that. It'll see who's on the network and who isn't. Yeah. Gratuitous ARP.
It uses gratuitous amounts of ARP to...
Gratuitous ARP?
Yeah, gratuitous ARP. That's a new version of ARP that I'm not familiar with.
No, it's just...
Gratuitous ARP. You ever notice when you pop your Windows machine on the network, it'll give you, 169, blah, blah, blah?
254.
Yeah, 169.254. Yeah, the way it knows whether there is an IP at that IP that it's giving you without BOOTP or DHCP or anything happy like that is it sends out a gratuitous ARP which says, I am the IP address that I want, this is my MAC address, nobody screw with me. And if anybody says, hey, I already got that, then it picks another random one and does it again. So it goes out and scans and see who is out there and takes the rest of the IPs on the network right now. Hopefully I'll make it so that you can pick the number that you want, but right now it just grabs everybody. Any other questions? Does anybody want some vodka? Come on up and get your vodka. Well, you said I only had one sip, so I figure it's fair game to give somebody else another sip.
Don't worry, it's over 40 proof, so it naturally sanitizes.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think of that one.
All right, anything else? Last chance, going once, going twice.
I think, actually,
gentleman in the back.
What? We got a lot more time, so we could talk about something else. Seth, you want to talk about Impulse Radio?
Not really.
Go, get your shit up here and talk about Impulse Radio. Say what? Well, you can explain it. You explained it pretty well to me. Come on. Yeah, yeah. Get down. Come on. Impulse Radio, everybody. This is another talk that apparently Seth has to do at some point or a presentation. So I'm going to make him do it now.
You don't have to stay if you don't want to. Feel free to get out of here. I'm going to have a seat. All right. Well, most of you guys are familiar with, 802.11b and that variant of wireless. And one of the big things about it is that it was designed for, pretty long-range stuff on the order of 100 to 1,000-meter transmission. It uses quite a bit of power comparatively, and it's very narrow spectrum, which means it operates right around 2.4 gigahertz for the 802.11b standard. And the idea with Impulse Radio is to make something that's spread spectrum, that means it operates across all frequencies at a low power, and it's not really meant for very high distances. So the one of the ideas is that you could, go out in a couple of years and buy a DVD player that's got support for Impulse Radio and keep it within, 10 feet of your TV and have all your video transmitted wirelessly to your television. So there's no need to run wires and stuff like that. So it's meant for indoor use and short-range communication. But one thing that's really cool is that it's very low power. The spectrum is spread from very low frequencies around, 1 megahertz all the way up to very high gigahertz frequencies. And it also doesn't have the same type of multiple access problems that that also plague Wi-Fi, where when one person's transmitting, another person can't transmit because their stuff just goes into oblivion. So if you've ever studied the way that CSMA CD works in an Ethernet, that you listen before you transmit, and if somebody's transmitting, you're nice and you don't send anything out on the wire. Well, the same thing kind of holds true with wireless, where if you listen and somebody's transmitting, then you don't transmit. But there's a problem that you can't listen and transmit at the same time, because if you try to listen, you'll just hear yourself. So in order to do that, they have to do some funny things where it's more of a collision avoidance than a collision detection. But anyway, back to impulse radio. Because it's so low power and wide and a wide frequency range, you can have multiple people transmit at the same time. And as long as you're listening along the right, you know, type of code, then you don't have to worry about it. It's like the analogy is if you've got a bunch of people in a room and everybody's talking, if you're tuning to try to listen to somebody, chances are pretty well that you can understand what they're saying, even if there's a lot of background noise. So that's the idea. The way that it works is instead of with Ethernet and Wi-Fi, instead of just sending your packet once, it sends it a whole bunch of times, and it counts in it. So if it sends it 500 times, the receiver listens, and for each of the 500 times, it tries its best to determine whether it was a one or a zero, and it, you know, keeps a running tally. And if that tally is then above a threshold, that single chunk is categorized, that their chips, as they're called, becomes a bit. So that's how. So you're sending it a lot of times. You get a lot of forward error correction. So it's pretty impervious to noise. And like I said, because it's spread spectrum, it's very, very hard to jam, because you have to spend a whole lot of power on a whole lot of frequencies, which isn't very easy to do, which is why people use spread spectrum for talking. I don't know.
Also, I'm told what you can do about gigahertz at a very short range and much slower at a very long range, because basically you're trading off the number of times that you send and the reliability for distance. So, you know, if it's far out, you got to send a lot more times, so it sends a lot slower. Whereas if it's closer, you can send fewer times and get the same reliability. I don't know, they profile that reliability. Do you know anything about that?
I mean, the way that all this stuff is analyzed mathematically is you add a noise function and give it a probabilistic number that depends. So, you know, sometimes it'll be more noise and things like that, and you can model it pretty well. But I mean, the big thing is that as your transmission gets further apart, it expands, and the amount of power at the receiver is down, so therefore it's hard to distinguish, again, the noise to power. That's where signal-to-noise ratios come in, that when the signal-to-noise ratio is high, you've got a lot, what is it? When your signal-to-noise ratio is high, you've got a lot of signal.
Yeah.
And then when it's low, you can't really distinguish the signal from the noise, but that's the way it works. So, yeah, so if there was a little graphic that I wasn't planning on doing this, so otherwise I'd show you, but basically if with ultra wideband radio at a distance of about a meter to 2 meters, you can push around a gigabit wirelessly, where and then when it drops to 10 meters, you're talking, you know, maybe 100 megabit, and that's just the function of having less noise, better signal, and fine-tuning the parameters.
I was just going to add that the part he talked about, the ranges, is all from that physics class you took in high school. It's I over D squared.
Yeah. So, anything else?
No, it was a very good impromptu talk. I'm sorry, we ran through the slides that we had real quick for the people who are just coming in, I guess. are there any other questions on either?
You mentioned a new problem.
Oh, yeah. Great new problem. Oh, yeah. Everybody's gotten scared by that reset thing. Everyone's freaking out. You can... All right. Someone came up with a new attack where, if you know how TCP works with congestion windows and everything, everyone understand congestion windows? Okay, cool. Okay. Somebody doesn't. Why don't you talk about congestion windows?
Well, TCP, obviously, it's designed to create an errorless, well, it tries to make an errorless connection. It pretty much turns a lossy connection that is the internet into a stream, so you can read to it like you're reading to a file and don't have to worry about errors and stuff like that. Well, in order to make it kind of optimized, TCP has what's called a congestion window. And for every every packet you send out, it wants to get an acknowledgement back saying that you received that packet successfully. Well, it's not very efficient to send out one packet, wait for the one acknowledgement, send out the next packet, wait for the next acknowledgement. So what it does is it creates what's called a congestion window, and it will send out as many packets as fill the congestion window without receiving the ACK. So if your congestion window is 8, TCP will allow 8 packets to be transmitted without having received an ACK. So that's like your lead time. So the idea behind it is that you can send out as many packets. Well, if that's how do I explain this? The idea is that in the amount of time that it takes your first packet to go and the ACK to come back, you could still have sent more packets to the receiver. So your congestion window, you want to be full in the amount of time it takes the first ACK to come back, and then that'll. So that's the idea. And then what also happens is that TCP increases your congestion window as it tries to learn the capability of the channel, which is why if you guys ever noticed it in, if you ever use Windows at work or anything, because I know nobody wants to run it at home, that your downloads in Internet Explorer generally start really fast and then slow down. What happens with TCP is that your congestion window grows exponentially. So it goes, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And when there's a loss, TCP cuts it in half. So it goes until it gets a loss, then it cuts it in half. And your congestion windows can be pretty big. I'd say you could expect, 16,000 packets to be the size of an average congestion window.
Big. So anyway, we had vodka already. My tequila guy's here, but we already had vodka. Normally what happens if you try to inject a packet into somebody else's TCP stream, you're going to find that the TCP sequence number, which is initially randomized, you have to put your packet with the proper TCP sequence number in the proper spot in the stream, or else it's going to get bitchy at you. I shouldn't have had that vodka. So what's happening is with this congestion window, there are a whole range of TCP sequence numbers that are valid at a given time. If it gets an actual packet, like a data packet, and then you inject a data packet that's in the congestion window, you're gonna find the slides. All right. If you inject a packet that's inside the congestion window and it's a data packet, what's going to happen is your packet's going to go in, and then the sender's packet's going to go there, and it's going to say it's a duplicate packet, and one of them will get thrown out. However, if it is a reset packet or a TCP control packet of some kind, what's going to happen is it's going to read that reset and use it before it actually decides if it's a duplicate packet or not. So if you can guess this, you don't have to guess the actual sequence number. You only have to guess a number that's inside the current congestion window, and then that reset will be processed. So somebody found this out and found that they could guess in about 4 numbers. It would take them about, 15 seconds was his estimate. So he predicted doom and gloom for all longstanding TCP sessions, one of which being BGP, which is, obviously a big part of routing on the internet. So everybody's talking about this and the governments are going nuts, or so they say. However, if you've got a core router, obviously you're going to have an interface that is primarily connected to other core routers. You're not just going to get let like the oi polloi of the internet kind of sit on your uplink that is reserved for other core routers where they send these BGP packets and have these great long TCP connections. So in order to actually cause core routers to dampen, which is what's going to happen if you start resetting their TCP connections, you're going to already have to have compromised another core router. And when you have compromised a core router, dampening other core routers directly connected to you is not like the biggest concern we have. So it's not really the big concern that people are making it out to be.
Also, another thing, a few years ago, there was an RFC for using MD5 checksums with TCP packets for BGP. If you haven't enabled that, why not? Or maybe you should actually get a CCNA or someone to do that for you. The basic point is that they worked around this problem years ago, and the people that are getting hit are, for example, the same amount or type of people that didn't install Windows service packs. It's like changing the oil in your car. It's something you got to do. Any questions on what we just spoke about or anything else?
I think they're being polite and waiting for us to finish before they leave.
Is that the case? All right. You just got here, so you probably have some questions. Oh, no, you're leaving.
Oh, no, he's going. He's being polite.
Okay.
Why don't we let them go?
Huh? Yeah, all right. We're just about done here, unless somebody has any other questions related to TCP and stuff like that. No problem. It wasn't mine.
Yeah.